Chapter 10. They moved camp three times in November, keeping to the south bank of the river, following it back towards the west. Slowly the wagons, which they had emptied of ivory beside the waterhole, began to fill again, for the game was concentrated along the river. The rest of the land was dry, but now each day there was promise of relief. The clouds that had been scattered across the sky began to crowd together, gathering into rounded, dark-edged masses, or rearing proudly into thunderheads. All of nature seemed impressed by their growing importance. In the evenings the sun dressed them in royal purple, and during the day the whirlwinds did dervish dances for their entertainment. The rains were coming. Sean had to make a decision. Cross the Limpopo and cut himself off from the south when the river flooded, or stay where he was and leave the land beyond undisturbed. It wasn't a difficult decision. They found a place where the banks flattened out a little on both sides of the river. They unloaded the first wagon and double-teamed it. Then, with everybody shouting encouragement, the oxen galloped down the steep slope into the riverbed. The wagon bounced behind them until they hit the sand, where it came to a halt, tilted at an abandoned angle, with its wheels sunk axle-deep into the sand. "On to the spokes!" shouted Sean. They flung themselves on the wheels and strained to keep them turning. But half the oxen were down on their knees, powerless in the loose footing. "Damn it to hell!" Sean glared at the wagon. "Outspan the oxen and take them back. Get out the axes." It took them 3 days to lay a bridge of corduroyed branches across the river, and another two to get all the wagons and ivory to the far bank. Sean declared a holiday when the last wagon was manhandled into the lager and the whole camp slept late the next morning. The sun was high by the time Sean descended from his wagon. He was still muzzy and a little liverish from lying abed. He yawned wide and stretched like a crucifix. He ran his tongue round his mouth and grimaced at the taste. Then he scratched his chest and the hair rasped under his fingers. "Candela, where's the coffee? Don't you care that I am nearly dead from thirst? And cozy, the water will boil very soon." Sean grunted and walked across to where Ember Janey squatted with the other servants by the fire watching Candela. "This is a good camp, Ember Janey." Sean looked up at the roof of the leaves above them. It was a place of green shade, cool in the late morning heat. Christmas beetles were squealing in the wide-stretched branches. "There is good grazing for the cattle," Ember Janey agreed. He stretched out his hand toward Sean. "I found this in the grass. Someone else has camped here." Sean took it from him and examined it, a piece of broken china with a blue fig-leaf pattern. It was a shock to Sean that little fragment of civilization in the wilderness. He turned it in his fingers, and Ember Janey went on. "There are the ashes of an old fire there, against the shumar tree, and I found the ruts where wagons climbed the bank at the same place as ours." "How long ago?" Ember Janey shrugged. "A year, perhaps. Grass has grown in the wagon tracks." Sean sat down in his chair. He felt disturbed. He thought about it and grinned as he realized he was jealous. There were strangers here in the land he was coming to regard as his own, Those year-old tracks gave him a feeling of being in a crowd. Also, there was the opposite feeling, that of longing for the company of his own kind, the sneaking desire to see a white face again. It was strange that he could resent something and yet wish for it simultaneously. "Candela, am I to have coffee now or at supper tonight? In Corsi it is done." Candela poured a little brown sugar into the mug, stirred it with a stick, and handed it to him. Sean held the mug in both hands, blowing to cool it, then sipping and sighing with each mouthful. The talk of his Zulus passed back and forth about the circle, and the snuff boxes followed it, each remark of worth being greeted with a solemn chorus of it is true," and the taking of snuff. Small arguments jumped up and fell back again into the leisurely stream of conversation. Sean listened to them, occasionally joining in or contributing a story, until his stomach told him it was time to eat. Candela started to cook, under the critical supervision and with the helpful suggestions of those whom idleness had made guardulous. He had almost succeeded in grilling the carcass of a guinea fowl to the satisfaction of the entire company, when Envijani felt that he should have added a pinch more salt. When Nonga, sitting across the fire from him, jumped to his feet and pointed toward the north, Sean shaded his eyes and looked. "For Christ's sake," said Sean. "Ah, ah, ah," said his servants. A white man rode towards them through the trees. He cantered with long stirrups, slouched comfortably, close enough already for Sean to make out the great ginger beard that marked the bottom half of his face. He was a big man. The sleeves of his shirt rolled high around thick arms. "Hello!" shouted Sean, and went eagerly to meet him. The rider reined in at the edge of the laager. He climbed stiffly out of the saddle and grabbed Sean's outstretched hand. Sean felt his finger bones creak in the grip. "Hello, man. How goes it?" He spoke in Afrikaans. His voice matched the size of his body, and his eyes were on a level with Sean's. They pumped each other's arms mercilessly, laughing, putting sincerity into the usual inanities of greeting. "Candela, get out the brandy bottle," Sean called over his shoulder. Then to the Boer, "Come in. You're just in time for lunch. We'll have a dram to celebrate. Hell, it's good to see a white man again." "You're on your own then." "Yes. Come in, man. Sit down." Sean poured drinks, and the Boer took one up. "What's your name?" he asked. "Courtney. Sean Courtney. I'm Jan Paulus Leroux. Glad to meet you, Mynheer." "Good health, Mynheer," Sean answered him, and they drank. Jan Paulus wiped his whiskers on the palm of his hand and breathed out heavily, blowing the taste of the brandy back into his mouth. "That was good," he said, and held out his mug. They talked excitedly, tongues loose from loneliness, trying to say everything and ask all the questions at once. Meetings in the bush are always like this. Meanwhile, the tide was going out in the bottle, and the level dropped quickly. "Tell me, where are your wagons?" Sean asked. "An hour or two behind. I came ahead to find a river." "How many in your party?" Sean watched his face, talking just for the sound of it. "Ma and Pa, my little sister, and my wife. Which reminds me, you'd better move your wagons." "What?" Sean looked puzzled. This is my outspan place, the boer explained to him. See, there are the marks of my fire. This is my camp. The smile went out of Sean's voice. Look around you, boer. There is the whole of Africa. Take your pick, anywhere except where I'm sitting. But this is my place. Jan Paulus flushed a little. I always camp at the same place when I return along a spoor. The whole temper of their meeting had changed in a few seconds. Jan Paulus stood abruptly and went to his horse. He stooped and tightened the girth, hauling so savagely on the strap that the animal staggered off balance. He flung himself onto its back and looked down at Sean. Move your wagons, he said. I camp here tonight. Would you like to bet on that? Sean asked grimly. We'll see, Jan Paulus flashed back. We certainly shall, agreed Sean. The boer wheeled his horse and rode away. Sean watched his back disappear among the trees, and only then did he let his anger slip. He rampaged through the laager, working himself into a fury, pacing out frustrated circles, stopping now and then to glare out in the direction from which the boer's wagons would come. But under all the external signs of indignation was his unholy anticipation of a fight. Cantilla brought him food, hurrying along behind him with the plate. Sean waved him away impatiently and continued with his pugnacious patrol. At last, a trek whip popped in the distance, and an ox lowed faintly, to be answered immediately by Sean's cattle. The dogs started barking, and Sean crossed to one of the wagons on the north side of the laager and leaned against it with assumed nonchalance. The long line of wagons wound out of the trees towards him. There were bright blobs of colour on the high box seat of the lead wagon. Women's dresses. Ordinarily they would have made Sean's nostrils flare like those of a stud stallion, but now his whole attention was concentrated on the larger of the two outriders. Jan Paulus cantered ahead of his father, and Sean, with his fists clenched into bony hammers at his sides, watched him come. Jan Paulus sat straight in the saddle. He stopped his horse a dozen paces from Sean and shoved his hat onto the back of his head with a thumb as thick and as brown as a fried sausage. He tickled his horse a little with his spurs to make it dance, and he asked with mock surprise, "What, Ruinek, still here?" Sean's dogs had rushed forward to meet the other pack, and now they milled about in a restrained frenzy of mutual bottom-smelling, stiff-limbed with tension, backs a-bristle, and legs cocking in the formal act of urination. "Why don't you go and climb a tree? You'll feel more at home there," Sean suggested mildly. "Ah, so!" Jan Paulus reared in his stirrups. He kicked loose his right foot, swung it back over his horse's rump to dismount, and Sean jumped at him. The horse skittered nervously, throwing the boer off balance, and he clutched at the saddle. Sean reached up, took a double handful of his ginger beard, and leaned back on it with all his weight. Jan Paulus came over backwards, with his arms windmilling, his foot caught in the stirrup, and he hung suspended like a hammock, held at one end to the plunging horse, and at the other by his chin to Sean's hands. Sean dug his heels in, revelling in the boer's bellows. Galvanized into action by Sean's example, the dogs cut short the ceremony and went at each other in a snarling, snapping shambles. The fur flew like sand in a Kalahari dust storm. The stirrup leather snapped. Sean fell backwards and rolled to his feet just in time to meet Jan Polis's charge. He smothered the punch that the Boer bowled over arm at him, but the power behind it shocked him. Then they were chest to chest, and Sean felt his own strength matched. They strained silently, with their beards touching and their eyes inches apart. Sean shifted his weight quickly and tried for a fall. But smoothly as a dancer, Jan Polus met and held him. Then it was his turn. He twisted in Sean's arms, and Sean sobbed with the effort required to stop him. Upa Leroux joined in by driving his horse at them, scattering the dogs, his hippo-hide schlambok hissing as he swung it.
"Let it stand, you thunders, give over! Hey! Enough, let it stand!"
Sean shouted with pain as the lash cut across his back, and at the next stroke Jan Polus howled as loudly. They let go of each other, and massaging their whip-wheels retreated before the skinny old white-beard on the horse. The first of the wagons had come up now, and 200 pounds of woman, all in one package, called out from the box-seat.
"Why did you stop them, Upa?
No sense in letting them kill each other. Shame on you! So you must spoil the boys' fun. Don't you remember how you loved to fight? Or are you now so old you forget the pleasures of your youth? Leave them alone!"
Upa hesitated, swinging the schlambok and looking from Sean to Jan Polus.
"Come away from there, you old busybody," his wife ordered him.
She was as solid as a granite kopje, her blouse packed full of bosom, and her bare arms brown and thick as a man's. The wide brim of her bonnet shaded her face, but Sean could see it was pink and pudding-shaped, the kind of face that smiles more easily than it frowns. There were two girls on the seat beside her, but there was no time to look at them. Upa had pulled his horse out of the way, and Jan Polis was moving down on him. Sean went up on his toes, crouching a little, preoccupied with the taste he had just had of the other's strength, watching Jan Polis close in for the main course, and not too certain he was going to be able to chew this mouthful. Jan Polis tested Sean with a long right-hander, but Sean rolled his head with it, and the thick pad of his beard cushioned the blow. He hooked Jan Polis in the ribs under his raised arm, and Jan Polis grunted and circled away. Forgetting his scruples, Upa Leroux watched them with rising delight. It was going to be a good fight. They were well matched, both big men, under 30, quick and smooth on their feet. Both had fought before, and that often. You could tell it by the way they felt each other out, turning just out of reach, moving in to offer an opening that a less experienced man might have attempted and regretted, then dropping back. The fluid, almost leisurely pattern of movement exploded. Jan Polis jumped in, moving left, changed direction like the recoil of a whiplash, and used his right hand again. Sean ducked under it and laid himself open to Jan Polis's left. He staggered back from its kick, bleeding where it had split the flesh across his cheekbone, and Jan Polis followed him eagerly, his hands held ready, searching for the opening. Sean kept clear, instinct moving his feet until the blackness faded inside his head and he felt the strength in his arms again. He saw Jan Polis following him, and he let his legs stay rubbery. He dropped his hands and waited for Jan Polis to commit himself. Too late, Jan Polus caught the cunning in Sean's eyes and tried to break from the trap, but clenched bone raked his face. He staggered away, and now he was bleeding also. They fought through the wagons, with the advantage changing hands a dozen times. They came together and used their heads and their knees. They broke and used their fists again. Then, locked chest to chest, once more they rolled down the steep bank into the river bed of the Limpopo. They fought in the soft sand, and it held their legs. It filled their mouths when they fell and clung like white icing sugar to their hair and beards. They splashed into one of the pools, and they fought in the water, coughing with the agony of it in their lungs, floundering like a pair of bull hippos, their movements slowing down until they knelt facing each other, no longer able to rise, the water running from them, and the only sound their gasping for air. Not sure whether the darkness was actuality or a fantasy of fatigue, for the sun had set by the time they were finished, Sean watched Jan Polus starting to puke, retching with a tearing noise to bring up a small splash of yellow bile. Sean crawled to the edge of the pool and lay with his face in the sand. There were voices echoing in his ears, and the light of a lantern, the light was red, filtered through the blood that had trickled into his eyes. His servants lifted him, and he hardly felt them. The light and the voices faded into blackness as he slipped over the edge of consciousness. The sting of iodine woke him, and he struggled to sit up, but hands pushed him down. "Gently, gently, the fight's over." Sean focused his one eye to find the voice. The pinkness of Uma Leroux hung over him. Her hands touched his face, and the antiseptic stung him again. He exclaimed through puffed lips. "So, just like a man," Uma chuckled. "Your head nearly knocked off without a murmur, but one touch of medicine and you cry like a baby." Sean ran his tongue round inside his mouth. One tooth loose, but all the others miraculously present. He started to lift his hand to touch his closed eye, but Uma slapped it down impatiently and went on working over him. "Glory, what a fight!" She shook her head happily. "You were good, Carol. You were very good." Sean looked beyond her and saw the girl. She was standing in shadow, a silhouette against the pale canvas. She was holding a basin. Uma turned and dipped the cloth in it, washing out the blood before she came back to his face. The wagon rocked under her weight, and the lantern that hung from the roof swung, lighting the girl's face from the side. Sean's legs straightened on his cot, and he moved his head slightly to see her better. "Be still, young'un," Uma commanded. Sean looked past her at the girl, at the full, serene line of her lips and the curve of her cheek. He saw the pile of her hair fluff up in happy disarray, and then, suddenly penitent, slide down behind her neck, curl over her shoulder, and hang to her waist in a plait as thick as his wrist. "Katrina, do you expect me to reach right across to the basin each time? Stand closer, girl." She stepped into the light and looked at Sean. Green, laughing, almost bubbling green was the colour of her eyes. Then she dropped them to the basin. Sean stared at her, not wanting to miss the moment when she would look up again. "My big bear," Uma spoke with grudging approval, "steal our campsite, fight my son, and ogle my daughter.
If you go on like this, I might have to knock the thunder out of you myself.
Glory, but you're a dangerous one.
Katrina, you'd better go back to our wagons and help Henrietta seat your brother. Leave the basin on the chest there.
She looked at Sean once more before she left. There were secret shadows in the green. She didn't have to smile with her mouth.